As we celebrate 4th of July tomorrow, I like to think back to the people who won our liberties that we enjoy today. I think back to George Washington, the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army during the War of Independence, and his men fighting for their very lives and for their freedom. I think back to the men who fought during the War of 1812 and in World War I. I think of the greatest generation, those who fought in World War II and those who supported them at home. Even though the British were the foe in the War for Independence, they were our allies during the Second World War. The British people stood resolute before wave after wave of bombing attacks during the Battle for Britain. I think of the longest day, D-Day, and the victory over Europe. The fearless leader, Winston Churchill, in his that iconic photo of him going like this, "Victory!" The hard-fought battles in the Pacific and the peace that followed. Victory is amazing, but it comes at quite a cost. Before there is great victory, there is often great suffering. The glory of military victory is not found in coasting through life living in your parents' basement, but in hard-fought battles from which you may never return. This evening, we will see the glory of victory written across Psalm 21. This victory is the victory that God gives to His chosen king, the leader of His nation Israel. But as we read through this psalm, we will quickly realize that this is not just a king of Israel who died thousands of years ago, but this psalm points forward to God's forever king, Jesus Christ. We looked at Psalm 20, I think, 3 weeks ago. Psalm 20 is a prayer for victory, for the success of God's anointed king. Psalm 21 is a celebration of the victory the king has already won and a promise for victories to come. And then Psalm 22, which begins with, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Is a cry of God's suffering servant, and it points us to Jesus, who only had victory through his suffering. So with that in mind, let me read for you Psalm 21. The king shall joy in thy strength, O Lord, and in thy salvation how greatly shall he rejoice. Thou hast given him his heart's desire, and hast not withholden the request of his lips. For thou preventest him, so that means that God meets him or encounters him with the blessing of goodness. Thou settest a crown of pure gold on his head. He asked life of thee, and thou gavest it him, even length of days forever and ever. His glory is great in thy salvation. Honor and majesty hast thou laid upon him, for thou hast made him most blessed forever. Thou hast made him exceedingly glad with thy countenance. That's God's presence. For the king trusts in the Lord, and through the mercy or the steadfast love of the Most High, he shall not be moved. Thine hand shall find out all thine enemies. Thy right hand shall find out those that hate thee. Thou shalt make them as a fiery oven in the time of thine anger. The Lord shall swallow them up in his wrath, and the fire shall devour them. Their fruit shalt thou destroy from the earth, and by that he is meaning their children, their offspring, and their seed from among the children of men. For they intended evil against thee, they imagine a mischievous device which they are not able to perform. Therefore shalt thou make them turn thy back when thou shalt make ready thine arrows upon thy strings against the face of them. Be thou exalted, Lord, in thine own strength. So we will sing and praise thy power. Like many psalms, this psalm has a frame. Verses 1 and 13 are the frame for this psalm. The beginning and the end speak of the same thing. Rejoicing in the strength of the Lord. And this frame gives the theme of the psalm. The king and the people rejoicing in God's strength and power. Verses 2 to 6 speak of the blessing of past victory. Verses 8 to 12 speak of the promise of future victory. And in the middle of that is verse 7, which shows the king's trust in God to give him victory. So, number one, joy in God's strength. Joy in God's strength. This is the frame of the psalm. The king is strong and has victory, but his strength is from God. Because of this, God is to be praised for his strength and power that bring the victory. And there is serious celebration going on here in the king's part and the people's part. Even as we celebrate 4th of July tomorrow, let us not overlook the celebration happening in the scriptures, happening here in Psalm 21. In verse 13, there is singing and praise. In verse 1, there's not only joy, but great rejoicing. So both the king and his people rejoice in God's strength, which brings the victory. A great victory requires great celebration, wouldn't you think? Let us not miss the joy, the absolute great joy that is ours because of what Christ has done for us. Number two, the blessings of victory, verses 2 to 6. The blessings of victory. Verse 2 speaks of God answering the request of the king. A few weeks ago, when we looked at Psalm 20, we saw that Jesus offered up prayers to his Father. Save me! And Jesus was answered, his prayers were answered by God's power. Hebrews chapter 5 puts it this way. In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. Maybe it's not a theme we look at very often, but Jesus offered up prayers to his Father, and Jesus was answered, and God brought him victory. And we see that victory through the resurrection. So God answered the prayers of Jesus and gave him rich blessings. And there are three main blessings that the king receives. Now the verse, the wording here of verse 6, it says that God has made the king most blessed forever. And the idea behind these words is that the king is greatly blessed, but also that this blessing flows from him to others. And we can obviously see that in Jesus Christ, who is most blessed, but his blessing flows to others. So, briefly, three blessings. The first is life, in verse 4. He asked life of thee, and thou gavest to him. But this verse tips us off that this is no mere earthly king. The second part of verse 4, even length of days forever and ever. So this is obviously very quickly pointing to God's forever king, the Messiah, Jesus, who will reign and live forever and ever. The second blessing is glory, verse 5. His glory is great in thy salvation. So the king's glory, his splendor and his majesty, is made great by the Lord's salvation of him. And we talked about this a few weeks ago, but the king is glorified when his Lord, when Yahweh, saves him. And we'll think about that a little bit later at the end of the sermon. There is increased glory for the king because God brought him through battle to victory. So increased glory for the king because God brought him through the battle to victory. And the third blessing is God's presence in verse 6. The king is not just excited about victory, but he is excited about God's presence, being close to God. Think of Jesus. Think of all the blessings that God gave Jesus because of his life and his death. Think about life and glory and God's presence. I'm going to read a few passages here. And think about life, glory, and God's presence all wrapped up in one fantastic package that God gives his king. Psalm 16:11. You make known to me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. John 17:5. And now, Father, glorify me in your own presence with the glory that I had with you before the world existed. And then Hebrews 12:2, Jesus, who for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising it the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. So we see the joy, the presence, the glory, and the life are all wrapped up in this blessing that God has given his king. And then third, the king's trust in God. Verse 7, for the king trusts in the Lord, in Yahweh, and through the mercy of the Most High, he shall not be moved. He's steadfast. And all these blessings belong to the king because he trusted God to deliver him. Think about the life of Jesus. Think about his temptation, how he trusted in his Father to provide for him in his life and in his death and in his resurrection. The resurrection, the ascension, and the glorious return of Jesus are all signs that God gave victory to Jesus. Jesus conquered because of the steadfast love of God. Because of the mercy of God, Christ prevailed. Through temptation, through suffering, through death, and the grave, he was not moved. Think about everything that Christ went through, all the suffering. He was steadfast because he trusted in his Father. And then verses 8 to 12, the expectation of victory in the future. The expectation of victory. Now, as you look, if you pay close attention, you'll see that moving into, starting at verse 8 to verse 12, all the verbs are future, talking about what will happen in the future. The victory in verses 8 to 12 has three parts. Discovery, destruction, and defeat. And those are not original with me, but when I see something like that, three D's that describe something, I latch onto it. So they're good. I couldn't come up with anything better. So discovery, destruction, and defeat are the blessings of victory in the future. First, in verse 8, there's discovery. The king finds his enemies. They cannot escape. You cannot hide from God and from his king. I think of the great white throne judgment talked about in Revelation. Then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. From his presence, earth and sky fled away, and there was no place found for them. So nothing in creation can hide from God. Then there's destruction in verses 9 and 10. The enemies of the king, and obviously these are enemies of God's people and enemies of the Lord, all these enemies will be burned up in blazing fire. God will swallow them in his wrath. The destruction is so widespread that everyone is included. Children, offspring are swept away in the torrent of God's wrath. And may I remind you that this is part of the victory. Without bad guys, you can't have a battle. And you can't have victory without conquering the bad guys. Not only is God's wrath this part of the victory, it is part of the celebration. Yes, these people in the psalm are celebrating that the bad guys will get burned up in the end. I think we tend to be ashamed of the wrath of God. We acknowledge God's anger against sin and future judgment because we want to stay true to the Bible. We're Baptists. We believe in the Bible, and so we acknowledge that God's wrath is a real thing. But it seems that we almost want to apologize for it sometimes. Yes, God is God of wrath, but no, look over here, God's love. Now, obviously we want to say God is a judge, and he is wrath, but look at his love at the cross. But God's wrath against those who hate him is something that is clear in the Bible. And it is also something that the Bible celebrates. As I was looking over the sermon this evening, I was reminded of Revelation 18 and 19 at the fall of Babylon the Great, the world evil world system. And there is celebration in heaven at the judgment of the world. So you just read through the book of Revelation or the book of Psalms and see that there is celebration over the wrath of God on those who hate him. God's wrath is one part of his manifold glory, his multifaceted glory, and his wrath is one aspect of that glory. And my hope is that we are not part of that wrath of God in the end. In Revelation, it says, "Then the kings of the earth, and the great ones, and the generals, and the rich, and the powerful, everyone slave and free, hid themselves in caves and among the rocks of the mountains, calling to the mountains and rocks, 'Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of their wrath,'" that is the Lamb and the Father, "'for the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand?'" So his wrath and judgment are coming, and it is something to be celebrated in the Scriptures. And then lastly, the defeat is one of the future blessings of victory in verse 11 and 12. The plots in verse 11 of the evil people are foiled. They have all these evil plans against God's people, and God dashes their plans to pieces. And then in verse 12, the language might be a little bit strange, but the picture here is that the enemy has turned around and is running away in defeat. And then this thing about bowstrings and faces and stuff like that, it's think about an enemy fleeing with their backs turned, and then the armies of God drawing their bows and letting arrows fly against the fleeing enemy. So a picture of total defeat, a rout of the enemy. So discovery, destruction, and defeat. "It is for all this victory that the people praise God for his great power." Verse 13, "Be thou exalted, Lord, in thine own strength, so we will sing and praise thy power." So to conclude, I want to focus on this phrase, this in verse 5. The king's glory is great through God's salvation. The king's glory is great through God's salvation. I want to think back to World War II and the Greatest Generation. Would that generation been called the greatest generation without living through the Depression, without living through that great war? We can never know, because we can't rewrite history. But we do know that they did live through the hardships of the Depression and the horrors of the Second World War. It is for their perseverance through this momentous time in our country's history that they are remembered as the greatest generation. What showed the perseverance of the British people through World War II? It was that an island nation staved off starvation, invasion, and destruction, U-boats and bombers. They were shown to be strong in their darkest hour. So I want to think about that. What showed that generation of people to be great? It was their perseverance through suffering and the ultimate victory. And I want to think about that as we think about Christ's suffering and our suffering as well. I know, at least in Bible college, but I know we all do it, play the what if game. What if sin had never entered the world? What if Adam and Eve had never eaten the fruit? What if a Messiah was never promised? What if Jesus never came to earth as a man? What if he never faced the darkest hour known to humanity, his crucifixion? What if he never faced the wrath of God on the cross? Will we know the perseverance and glory of Jesus? The fact is that battle followed by victory gives great honor. Battle followed by victory gives great honor. Suffering with steadfastness shines forth glory. Jesus has greater glory because of his suffering and death for us. Now we have to be careful here. God, who he is in himself, who we cannot see, you can't make him more God and more glorious. Because if he could be better, he wouldn't be great. So you can't make God more glorious than he is in himself. However, that glory in our eyes shines brighter because of the work of Jesus for us. Philippians 2 reminds us that because of Christ's suffering on the cross, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. And Hebrews 2 says, but we see him, that's Jesus, who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death. Let me repeat that. He was crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. It was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, and bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect, complete, through suffering. So we know the greater glory of Jesus Christ because of his battles and his victory for us. His glory is made great through God's power and his salvation. We must remember, dear friends, that everything that God does, he does for his glory. For his glory. Think back to that question. What if there was never sin entered into the world? Well, the fall of the world into sin was not a horrific accident. It was horrific, but it was not an accident. It was planned by God to show the glory of his Son. And as we trace God's actions throughout the Bible, all the sin and the suffering was to shine light on Jesus who conquers it. Christ's glory is made great through God's salvation. His glory is made great through God's salvation. So all the bad stuff is not an accident. It is to make the sun's light shine greater. So that's Jesus' suffering. What about our suffering? Why doesn't God remove suffering from our lives when we are saved? He could do that. And I was thinking about this. I think about the 10 plagues in Egypt. The plague of darkness. The Egyptians were gnashing their teeth for 3 days because of the darkness. The land of Goshen, where the Israelites lived, it was light. In all the 10 plagues, God spared the Israelites, and the Egyptians suffered. Well, he could do that to us, couldn't he? He could spare all true Christians from suffering, and it would be awesome. And people are like, why don't I get into that? That would be great. But God does not do that. So why doesn't God do that? Here's two quick reasons. First, we follow in the footsteps of our suffering Savior. And that's written throughout the book of Hebrews, especially. And secondly, our suffering magnifies the glory of God. Again, God gets more glory when you suffer and persevere and make it to the end. His glory is made great through your salvation. His glory is made great through your perseverance. So don't grow weary in your suffering. Look to Jesus, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despised its shame, and is seated at the right hand of God. However dark this world may seem, and it is dark, and however painful your life is now, victory is coming, and it will be a glorious victory, and God's glory will shine great in our salvation. Let's bow in prayer. This time I want us to take a few moments to think on Christ's death for us, his victory, and confess our sin before him as we approach the table.